because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Awesome today to have Coach Matt Painter from Purdue with us. Coach, great success throughout your career. Going into your 15th year this coming year at Purdue and 11 NCAA tournaments in the last 13 years, three straight Sweet 16s, and this past year in the Elite Eight. And Coach, first off, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for taking some time.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Coach, I think there's so many coaches that would love to learn from you. So we've got a great opportunity today to be able to ask a bunch of questions. And I know a lot of coaches' instincts might immediately go to some offense because you guys ran some great offensive stuff this year. But I want to start with transition defense and some of the philosophy that I've heard you share. And if you could, especially the concept of getting a player to what you call the keyhole, can you talk a little bit about your defensive philosophy?
Yeah, well, I think we have a sport that obviously our offense and our defense is connected. And, you know, when you change over, you know, going from offense to defense or defense to offense, one is going to make the other one better. And sometimes we lose thought of that. And sometimes people say, hey, we got to work on defense. We got to be a better defensive team. But if you're more efficient offensively, you turn the ball over less and you take better shots, you just made yourself a better defensive team. You know, that's a kind of a profound statement, but I think we get lost in it and we try to separate it too much. We've moved to a little bit more of a football emphasis, even though it isn't totally football. You know, the guys who play on defense in football don't play on offense, but yet if they get an interception, you know, someone's got to block and someone's got to run, but it's rare. It's a small, small percentage of the game of football. And the same holds true, you know, on the offensive end. But in basketball, it's different. You know, your offensive and your defensive guys, you know, it's constantly, you know, in transition. So it's a big part of the game. One of the things that I always keep in my mind, something Rick Majerus talked about. I went and met with Jim Cruz when he was at St. Louis, and they talked about mental reps. And I thought this was something that was really intriguing to me because as coaches, you know, you really try to get to where your players are fresh at the end of the year, but yet, you know, you're sharp and you have that edge. And so how can you do some of those things as you progress? You know, we're very fortunate now to have 4 hours a week in the summer to work with our guys for an 8-week period. Then we have 4 hours once school starts leading up to the first practice. Then they've done a really good job of giving us more time to put in days in preseason, which is great for your players' bodies. And so in time, you know, do you need to get guys in shape? Without question. You know, do you need to lift year round? Without question. But you also, you're starting real practice in September and you hope to be really good in February, March. So you got to be really smart about those guys being in shape, those guys being ready, but not wearing them out. And, you know, some guys would start to kind of think that way in November, December, and you can't be that way. You know, you got to keep, you know, pushing them, you got to keep practicing, you know, not as long as you did in October. And each year, each month, you're just kind of tapering towards the end of the season. Well, with that, you know, Rick Majerus talked about mental reps. And so I'm just constantly thinking, like, when we're working on something, we got to work on more than just that. So if I'm working on offense or I'm working on sets, let's constantly be working on offensive rebound and setting our defense. So when we do shooting drills or we do dry offense, whether it's out of bounds play, side out of bounds play, sets, you know, when you run a lot of stuff, you have to be efficient. You know, everybody has stuff, but, you know, having good plays and being sloppy with it's not going to get you anywhere. The play's not magic. You know, you have to have good players, you have to have good execution, but that takes time. And so with that, you give your, you know, you give that time so you can execute offensively. And then you feel like as a coach, something's being pulled from you. And what I mean by that is like, okay, well, now we're giving all this time offensively. We're not as good defensively. Well, the one thing you can constantly do is when you're doing those things on the offensive end is work on your guys getting to the glass, work on your guys setting their defense and having your one safety, your two safety. We always pick up the basketball. And one of the main reasons we pick up the basketball is we don't want kick aheads. So when our guy comes into really, we say come into the keyhole, but you're really just kind of coming through as a rebounder into the nail. And if you can go get the basketball, great. But if you can't, now you have centered yourself. And anytime you've centered yourself as this guy who we call the jammer, who's picking up the basketball, anytime you've centered yourself, now your run, your furthest run is going to be 12 to 15 feet. So if they have you on a cross matchup and you're on the left wing and a shot goes up and you stay on the left wing and they outlet on the right wing, you have a long run to go get that basketball. And that's going to be difficult to do. So we always bring that guy through the keyhole. We always bring him in and we center him as a long rebound. As most know, you know, point guards aren't accustomed to boxing out. They're just not. And if they are, they normally go and help out maybe somebody in a rotation or they help out a big guy. But them thinking like, hey, my guy's going to get a rebound isn't something that comes to mind. And so they normally kind of just float. Well, this guy is coming in there. He's looking for those long rebounds. We're looking to get those things. And then we've led to where now this has helped us. We can get to that outlet guy right away. We make him go back to his baseline. And when he catches it, we want to be there. Even if the matchup isn't great where, you know, the guy at the ball has more quickness than him, we just want a pause there. We want a 1, 2, 3 seconds to where now we can crash. Now we have time to get back because of this. And then when he catches it, he can't catch the basketball and throw it ahead and get that kick ahead. So that time right there helps us get a couple more offensive rebounds a game. That time right there stops those kick aheads, and it helps with our transition defense in terms of setting it. What it led us to this year was, and once again, you can never get away from your personnel. We had some guys, Nojel Eastern was our guy that went to that keyhole a majority of the time. Grady Eifert, Matt Harms, Travion Williams, Evan Boudreaux. We had some guys that were around the basketball there. Aaron Wheeler did a really good job at the end of the year in a couple games. And so then we really worked, obviously, if you have a layup, we really worked on those kickout threes, which is a rhythm three, from our safeties now coming back into the play and looking to get another three. We shot the most threes in the history of the Big Ten this year. We made the most threes. Took some bad ones also to point, but we really worked towards setting our defense, being able to help ourselves offensively, you know, kind of by our setup there, limiting their transition opportunities, but also generating some offense for us. Generating some offense by here we're picking up, but now we can get some more offensive rebounds because when you take a lot of long shots, you're going to have a lot of long rebounds. And you don't want to be vulnerable now in transition. And now your long shot led to their run out. And now you have primary breaks at the other end, whether that's a 3-on-2 or a 2-on-1. Because obviously when you have two safeties and one of them shoots, especially when he shoots from the wing down to the corner, you know, you're a little bit more susceptible for that thing ricocheting out opposite, someone picking it up. So we have our guy kind of in there. It doesn't mean it's, you know, it's 100% and you're going to stop him all the time, but he's in that vicinity. And now when that ball squirts out there and gets funny, we really work on that guy really going and tracking the ball down, making it tough for that guy to see what's going on. And now we got another guy back, and then everybody else has got to hightail it back and try to get our defense set. So that's just something from a transition defense that we tried to do, but we also try, we work on it when we're working on offense at all times. In a shooting drill, you are a guy that if we do a 2-man shooting drill, a 3-man shooting drill, and there's only one ball involved, obviously you're going to have one or two guys. You know, what do they do in that drill? You know, you normally see guys, they pass it, something happens, they get a shot, the guy that passes it to them, he just goes to the end of the line. You know, that guy needs to get to the keyhole, that guy needs to get to the glass, or that guy needs to be a safety every single time. So we just try to program that into them. And then like when you're not as good defensively, you know, if you're doing a good job on the glass yourself and boxing people out and you're doing a good job in some of the transition defense that we talked about, then, you know, you're working on things and you're improving yourself by just some of those mental reps and just some of those, you have a place to be. When a shot goes up, you have a place to be. And I think that's really helped us. It's not a cure-all or anything, but it's just something little that I think you can steal some possessions with offensive rebounds and you can limit them some looks in transition.
Well, it's a great concept that I enjoyed hearing a little bit about and more there. And there's lots to unpack there. But the main thing for me was that there's a lot of statistical evidence now that a high percentage of rebounds on three-point shots go to that nail area. So it makes sense exactly what you're saying based on, and I haven't done an NCAA analysis. An NBA coach, TJ Saint, did an NBA analysis of that. But are there some stats to back that up in terms of a high percentage of the rebounds go to the nail area?
Well, I think the theory always has been, and this is what, and I don't have numbers to back it up. The theory has always been, you know, to get opposite. And I think the numbers would support getting opposite. And there's three general areas the ball can go. And so like what you tell the guy who's closing out on the shot at all times is the ball's coming back to you. And that just, it's a good thing to just ingrain in their mind. Anytime you close out, anytime you contest a shot, the ball's coming back to you. Even if it's a, you're trying to fly at a guy at the end, when you land and you come back, you got to get back in front of that guy and fight for that ball, because the ball is coming back to you. Now, obviously, we know that ball's not always coming back to you, but right. That's what you have to put in that guy's mind. If you're the center of the court and you're in help side and you have to get back, it's so important. The one thing that, you know, I think is gets lost here and it doesn't get talked about enough is, and it's something that from the ground up, like when you come as a player, guys just don't do this. If I'm away from the basketball, and especially if my guy doesn't go and rebound, my guy's a safety. So I think it's important to educate your guys on who's going, who's not. You know, you always know, you know, your fours and fives are normally going to go. You know, your three, you know, just depends on what group and what team you're going up against. Some twos will go, but some points, like we have our point going. So people should know that. Like, who's going to the offensive glass? Who's there? But the thing that happens is when the guys that don't go and you're away from the ball, they run to the rim on a 22-foot shot. And it's the worst thing you can do. If no you're question, out at 15 yeah. feet, you need to hold. You need to take a step towards your man, even if he doesn't go and you know he's not going, because that step allows that time, whether that's a one count or a two count. It goes pretty quick because shots don't stay in the air that long. But it allows the space for you now to have more room to get that long rebound. And so when we tell those guys that are opposite, it's like, don't run to the rim. Everybody's programmed to run to the rim. On short shots, run to the rim. On long shots, take a step back, go to box your man out. If he comes, get a piece of him and go get the ball. If he doesn't come, that step, those two steps, whatever you made, and that time you created now gives you more space so the ball doesn't fly over your head. That happens a lot. But kind of back to your, you know, your question, getting opposite, if you have a chance and your man's away, you get opposite. You go hit and go get the ball. That's the smartest thing to do. Just because the ball comes to the middle some doesn't mean that it's always going to come to the middle. It just depends. When you get off the elbow area kind of down to the corner, that ball will kind of come opposite elbow and come middle a lot. But I still think it goes opposite more. Obviously, we're splitting hairs because it is the same technical area that you're there. So what we try to do is get opposite with those guys when they're on weak side. If you're already, you know, kind of weak side and you're hugged up with your man and you're there, step to him, you've already created your space, and then, you know, be able to get into that middle part of the area. And our guys that do that kind of figure those things out after a while because we beat that into them to be able to do that. And I think if you do that with your guys that close out on the ball, especially when it's on a wing, they're always fighting to get back into that play. And then your other guys kind of take the theory that we just talked about of being opposite or being there. You've covered all your right. bases. And sometimes like the hardest rebounds are those bad misses or those scud missiles that, you know, those are hard. You know, the ball hitting the backboard first, air balls, barely hits the rim, bad shooter just taking a shot he shouldn't take. You know, those are difficult. You know, you try to program your guys, you know, to the actual kind of good misses, so to speak, and the likelihood of what should happen, and then putting themselves in that position. So we all in rebounding, we always say when you're in good position, you can get a piece of somebody, go get the basketball, hold your box out. When you're two passes away, when you're one pass away, you should box them out. I'm one pass away, I'm touching my guy, whether I'm in post defense or whether I'm one pass away, you know, try to get a box out. You're pretty close to your man. In any circumstance, when you're in help or anything of those things happen and you get behind a play, don't, you know, scrap everything I just said, go get the ball, keep it alive, yeah. Go get the basketball, understand. You know, I think offensively you work from a free throw line standpoint, you work on, if you can't get to it, you know, tap it back because you're setting your defense, you know, you have a safety or two, you know, in play. But from a defensive standpoint, it's better to tell those guys to go get it with two hands, tapping it sometimes, you know, you can tap it to your guy, but you can also tap it to their guy and they're at the basket. So you're more susceptible there. So you really want to kind of focus. We do some different drills where we focus on, you get 2 points for two-handed rebounds, you get 1 point for one-handed rebound, just to try to, you know, to kind of set that habit. Because a lot of things that get lost is your lack of concentration more than your lack of strength or your lack of ability to go get the ball.
This is good stuff. Let's focus back on the keyhole is your point guard going there. And then you mentioned going to the glass. How many are you sending to the glass?
We send two. We send our four and our five to the glass. Now, it just depends. Like you go personnel based, and so
and
sometimes
is it scouting
you know,
when you say personnel, do you mean scouting report or do you mean your players?
Our players. Our players.
Okay.
And so and sometimes you go on the discipline or lack thereof of one of your key guys. You know, sometimes you'll have a guy that's just, you know, we had a guy named Dakota Mathias and like, you know, Ryan Klein, like those guys did what they're supposed to every time when it came to being a safety. You have a guys that get into the keyhole, like, you know, they, you know, No Joe Eastern was really good. He was our point guard. He led us in rebounding this year. And so like trying to grab the value of a player sometimes is different. Like some people say, oh, so this guy is a great safety. Like, you know, who's ever put that on a scouting report? Like, who's ever put that on someone's value? Like, this guy gets back on defense every single time. Yeah. But we all know getting back on defense is important. But yet, it's never been on a scouting report. But some guy doing a 360 helicopter dunk that's going to happen four times a year is something like, hey, man, he's athletic. He can jump over the moon. But yet, he averages 3.5 rebounds a game. But yet, he can do, you know, helicopter dunks. And people are like, did you see this? So he goes on social media four times, and Dakota Mathias got centered as a safety 1,100 times, and it helped us win a game. But you don't look at Dakota Mathias' value as helping you win a game. But this guy here is impressive. And to me, I could care less if you could do a helicopter dunk. If you're not going to play defense and rebound and use the athleticism the good Lord gave you, you know. So that production is so much more important in those areas. And so when you go and find people, because he's kind of the prototypical efficient player. He came as a guy that you didn't think was a defensive player, and then yet he was a two-time all-defensive player. You know, he didn't make all-conference from our league, but yet if we had a draft and there was 15 people that got to get picked, all the coaches in our league would pick him. I promise you that. He played on two sides. He shot 40% from three. He had the third-best assist-turnover ratio in the history of our school. He made 80% of his free throws. He's the best decision maker I ever coached. Great defensive player. He was always a safety. He knew what was going on, caused you no problems. And so, like, guys like him sometimes get lost, but yet whenever he's on a team, everybody appreciates and everybody values him. But yet as you grow and you, like, you look at things and you go back to evaluate, the same people that would agree with what I say wouldn't rank him high in high school.
Right.
Well, don't rank him as high. And so it's like, it's a weird deal sometimes, like what we like and what helps us win sometimes isn't looked at favorably by people that watch basketball a lot. And so those are the kind of the people that we're really trying to get is like, you hear football coaches say it more than basketball coaches, but basketball coaches, you know, say it a lot like, hey, like do your job. You know, do your job. I talk to high school guys all the time and they'll ask my opinion about something and I'll say, hey, do what your coach tells you to do. I'm not there every day in practice. I can go watch your games and I can kind of, you know, I can give a stab at it, but I'm not there every day. I don't know what I can guess what he's saying, but I think that's what happens with a lot of guys across the board is that everybody has a general opinion about stuff. When in reality, if you're not there every single day and you're not in practice every single day, you don't realize what's getting emphasized and what guys need to do. So I know I got off it a little bit right there, but
no, it's great.
It's a really important piece to the game, you know, being able to do what you're supposed to do.
Well, and this podcast it's coaches listening. So it's beyond just a fan listening. And that's kind of the point you're making is basically some of those unseen things that coaches appreciate and other people might not notice as much. And that speaks to everything that we're talking about in terms of your transition defensive system. So, Coach, what are some of the responsibilities or goals for the safety in terms of getting back? What are they doing first?
Yeah, the main thing for them to do is get centered. You know, if you can be on the left or right-hand side of the court, if you float back to half court and you stay on that side, you know, you just kept your run a little bit longer if the ball ends up going on the other side. If you get pushed to one side or the other and you float back and you don't get turned around, it allows creases and openings for people to sprint behind you. But if you get centered and you get turned around and you get deep as the ball's going, you're going to be able to make an educated decision on when to come out of the lane as the ball starts to cross half court and get deeper. Obviously, you're going to make mistakes and you always don't get a great quality jam. And you can see that now you get turned around. So when we have two safeties with the group we just had, and if both of them get there and they get turned around and they see things, now one of them can definitely come out quick because the other one's there. If you only have one guy back because one of those guys shot the ball, there was a turnover, and now he's there, he's got to hold a little bit longer and secure some things because you don't want to float out to the left or the right when you don't have to. You know, like I don't need to go get my man when he's at 40 feet, but he's about a second and a half away from being in a position. So I want to hold as long as I can. It just depends on who's in front of their man in terms of the big run into the rim, you know, guys running to the left or the right, and different people, you know, draw different attention. And we try to do it from an offensive end. Just you're sprinting and you getting up the court can bring some people out from the rim, and now we can drive that basketball, or we can kick it ahead, and we can throw it directly to the big run, and whatever it might be. So we just try to get those guys back and say, you know, get centered, you know, don't float back, run back, get turned around. And, you know, we do it in breakdown drills and stuff, and they get, you know, sometimes they can get casual with it, and we keep harping on it and stuff. And you go back and watch the tape, and sometimes things go quick when you see things live because you're watching one end and then you go to the other end real quick and you're like, God, man, they got us right there. And you go back, it's because your guy floated back as a safety. He didn't run back, get turned around in direct traffic. Sometimes when people have advantages, especially against good teams, you know, when you get in those primary breaks and, you know, you're on the short end of it and you're on defense, you know, they're going to score sometimes. Obviously, they have an advantage. You know, they have a 3-on-2 or a 4-on-3 or a 3-on-1 or whatever it might be. They're going to score some of those, but you're trying to limit those to the best of your ability by getting centered. So that's really the focus that we really try to tell those guys is get back, get centered, get turned around. You know, you're the free safety in football at that point. You got to make educated decisions. Something in basketball that gets lost sometimes in philosophy when you're talking to guys. And just think about this in general, like, why should I gamble when we're already a man down? It's a really good point, and it's a good question to ask your players. Why should we gamble? What guys will do when they get put in vulnerable situations when they are a man down, they think they got to make a play at that time. It's the last thing you want. You know, what do you want? Do you want, as a defensive player, do you want someone to shoot a pull-up 15-footer when it's 2-on-1, or do you want to dunk? Well, obviously, you want to pull up 15-footer. Well, you got to work on those things and say, when you get in this situation, we're going to live with that. You know, when we get into a 3-on-2 break, you know, the one thing we stop is we stop the ball, we protect the rim, and then we know where skill is. So make sure they know priorities. And 4-on-3, we're in a more of a scramble mode in 4-on-3 because we have enough people. We can always have what? The ball. We can always have a pass away. We can always protect the rim. Problem that'll happen there sometimes is when the ball gets centered, you know, now you have two people that could be one pass away. So you have the ball, you protect the basket, you're one pass away with one guy, then the other guy is susceptible. That's where the next guy's coming in. They got to be able to see that. You know, when you're the last guy running back, you know, on defense, you can't make a poor decision. You see everything. You see nine people. You know, you're like a catcher in a baseball field. When you're coming back and you're the last two guys on the court, what happens is big dudes will just run to their man. So here you got, you know, you pick up, they'll just run to their man. You're like, hey, I got my man back. I know you had him, but now you got to go get yours. And so you got to really program guys to understand when it's a break, when they have something, what's going on. And you got to spend a lot of time doing it, but you also got to spend a lot of time of getting in different scenarios, filming it and watching them and saying this scenario, do X, Y, and Z versus the other one. So we're constantly trying to get those safeties to understand that. And then the guys that come into play, you know, understand if guys are attacking and they're going to get something off of it and I'm coming into a play, what are we doing? We're not matching up. We're rebounding because I'm late to the party. I got to go get the rebound. But if you see that, hey, we've got the ball stopped, we've secured some things, now everybody's going to do what? Quick reversal. You attack, quick reversal. Now make them match up or whatever. And you got some big just kind of floating back to his man. You got to be able to understand that as a defender coming in. So those are just kind of some of the things that we really discuss and talk about. But those safeties getting centered, those safeties getting turned around, them, you know, starting to, you know, direct traffic where people need to go, but they got to direct traffic with their voice, but they got to direct traffic with their action and their bodies about being aggressive. I'm big on, if I got the ball, I'm pressuring the ball so we can limit their vision. If I can get a guy to put the ball on the ground and dribble east and west while we're down a man, man, it's limiting his vision. He's not moving the basketball. He's not passing it. He's dribbling it. And now those guys are, you know, I'm buying time for my teammates to get back so we can get everything squared up and be 5-on-5.
Yeah, it's great depth in your teaching, but also in the importance of your players understanding their responsibilities. So, Coach, you talked about connectedness, how connected offense and defense are. So let's connect a little bit to the offensive side of the ball. Does your value of the keyhole or the nail, does that influence you, your outlets on offense? Are you trying to get outlets more down the middle of the floor because you know that that's a valuable rebounding spot, or is there no connection there between those two?
Yeah, there's no connection to there. You know, you obviously want to be able to get an outlet more in terms of the guy kind of looping to the ball, or if it's, you know, if it's traditional, when it's on one side of the court, you want your guy to be able to get his butt to the sideline and then work his way up the boards to get it on the run. If he can't, then he's got to make a shallow cut, like I talked about, to come back and shorten the distance and get the ball on the run that way. But yeah, I don't, you know, the thing that you just try to stop in those situations is outletting the ball across the goal. You know, you get the ball one side or the other, and there's going to be times you get rebounds in the middle. You just got to be careful. You got to be able to chin the basketball and not dribble, because a lot of times guys are flying in and you can't see what's behind you. So if you're not a ball handler, be able to chin that and always think somebody's there behind you. But if you get the ball to the left or the right, securing the ball, turning and putting your backside on a guy and being able to outlet to the side, just kind of take some repetition. And if you're not really good at it, don't worry about it. You know, value the basketball more than want to kind of ignite the break. But if you end up being pretty good at it, some big guys they're good passers. They're good decision makers. We all have those instances where you just have that kind of that careless pass, even when it's not getting pressure, where you don't have that timing. I just try to encourage guys that can pass and that do have a feel for it to look for those guys and be aggressive. The guys that aren't that good of a passers, you know, be simple, make a solid play. Even if there's a little risk to it, just leave it alone. Just leave it alone. Make that guy, and that guy will get mad at you sometimes. And like, you know, hey, hit me, whatever. If you don't feel comfortable about it, don't, you know, hold that ball. We work like hell to get it. You know, don't give it back to somebody. So that's an important piece.
And it comes back to the decision maker and them making the right decision for them. And that's great.
Correct.
Now, you've moved away from motion in your career, and now you're more sets. And you've talked a little bit about playing football is kind of the way I would describe kind of how it seems like you guys play. Another coach mentioned this to me, and you've mentioned football a few times. So, like, every time down, you're essentially getting into a set. But what I think you do better than a lot of the NCAA teams that I've seen is that you run a lot of false action or a lot of masking action, pre-snap motion, before the primary action. Can you talk a little bit about moving away from motion to sets a little bit, and then some of this philosophy?
Yeah.
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world, and now you can learn from him with never before available access. 3 all-access practices and 1 defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's force weak hand defensive system is world renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game, who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all 4 videos.
Well, we still work on motion. When you have a high volume shooter like we have, it looks like you don't run as much because you shoot the ball quicker. And so if you come to our practices, nothing's really changed, but we've went from having balance the year before, when we had Vince Edwards, Isaac Haas, Dakota Mathias, Carson Edwards. Those were mainly the 4 guys we ran stuff for. And then the previous year, you had Caleb Swanigan in that group. So we got the ball to Isaac a lot. We got the ball to Swanigan a lot. And Swanigan was a good passer. And then we got the ball to Dakota and Vince. And, you know, those were kind of the 4 guys. And then Carson kind of played off of those guys. We didn't run a lot of stuff for Carson at that time as a freshman. We ran a little bit more as a sophomore, and obviously we ran a lot, you know, his junior year. So you know, we've had really good size. We went three straight years with getting the ball inside more than anybody in the country, but our better guys and our better scorers were guys that played the four and the five for us. And so that's really what we're able to do. But if you run a lot of motion and you need to get the ball inside, it won't get in as much. It just won't. You know, you have to run stuff to get, you know, the ball inside. Now with the group that we had this year, we just felt like we had to run a lot of different action for them, but we also had to be able to manipulate the defense at times and what you're talking about and camouflage a lot of stuff with some action going away. Anytime, you know, we ran a lot of stuff where you're trying to get one action and you're trying to get two action. And then if you don't have it, what does everybody in the world do? We'll come up here and set a ball screen. And that drives me bananas. I hate that. And I'm a guy that doesn't always call a timeout in certain situations, because why do I want them to, you know, set up defensively and talk about what we're going to do and give them a chance to set their defense, give them a chance to change their defense. I got them in one defense. I know what they're doing. We can call a play, but we put a lot of time into it and we worked it. But what you're talking about is that total manipulation of the defense. And that's what we're trying. It's no different than me throwing you a fastball out of the strike zone and then me throwing you a straight change about in the same area. So you feel like, hey, I need to move this ball over and to throw the same pitch. It's having movement on a ball that you're pitching versus not having movement on a ball and then your placement of it and doing different things. There's no, it's nothing different in any other different sport than that manipulation. It's like, I read a football book the other day and they were talking Bill Walsh, the guy that goes in motion in football happened because Bob Trumpy, an old tight end for the Bengals, lined up on the wrong side when Bill Walsh was an assistant for Paul Brown with the Bengals. And he lined up on the wrong side and he moved from the right side to the left side right before the ball was getting ready to get snapped because they're screaming at him to get to the other side. Well, it, you know, he went in motion technically, but really he just lined up the other side and it freaked the defense out. It bothered them when he did that because they thought, oh, this is a different formation. This is something, whatever. And it moved two different guys on the defensive side of the ball. And they're like, oh, hey, we got something here. We went in motion. And yeah, that's how it started. But it changes. And so all that stuff that you see from a football standpoint or from a pitching standpoint is all to set something else up for that to work. Obviously, you would like the first thing to work. So when we run a lot of our different stuff, if people aren't disciplined in what you're doing and understand what you're doing in terms of running a particular action, running some triple action, running dribble handoff after a down screen and bringing a guy behind. And so we run, you know, a handful of different things, but a lot of different options off those things. And now you have to be able to have discipline with what you're doing and with what your rules. And if you're going to overdo somebody, if you're going to double them, if you're going to, you know, now slips are going to come into play. If you're not going to be disciplined in what you're going to do, now fake handoffs are going to come into play. But if you're going to be disciplined and you're going to be steady and you're going to be able to do things, now we're going to be able to get the ball to Carson Edwards or Ryan Klein, where they got a chance to shoot kind of running threes, dribble off threes, you know, slips off ball screens, being able to get in to their pull up. So we run a lot of different stuff with it. We stole everything. And there's a couple things that we probably ever originated in terms of what we run, but a lot of right. What we do is just different actions that we see, that we steal, that we incorporate, and then we try to make them into shooting drills. So our core of what we do with our certain group that we think is going to work in that game, now we have 2 days to prepare. We just kind of make them into shooting drills. And so now they're getting, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30 shots off this one action. You know, you got to be able to kind of distort the defense. Also, you find a good offensive team, you'll find a team that shot fakes a lot, pass fakes a lot, sets their man up, does little things to get separation off a screen. So all those things lead to angles. All those things lead to forcing the defense to be able to be disciplined. And then you have to have intelligent players. You have to have guys that understand the game that can make those decisions. Sometimes our strength was in our ability to shoot the basketball this year. But sometimes we struggle in our ability to make good decisions. When we make good decisions, our skill comes out. A lot of people think that about shooting. You find me someone that can shoot, I'll find you someone I can stay with. You find me someone that I can move and shoot, now I got a little bit different problem. If you can just stand still and shoot the basketball, I'm not going to leave you because threes are so important. So from a defensive standpoint, you show me someone who can speed cut and sprint and set their man up and pass fake, shot fake, get the ball where it needs to be and make plays and make shots. Now I got a different assignment defensively, and that's really hard to guard. when you don't know what that guy's holding in his hand, that's really difficult. And so we run a lot of that different action, but kind of back to your motion. If you came to our practice, there wouldn't be a day that you didn't see 5-on-0 motion, you know, 7 passes, 5 passes, you know, you got to get certain actions, you know, you got to speed cut, you got to call out your screens. And so we work on those things, but when we get into a groove and you see that the actions that we think that are going to work are working, we don't go away from it. We kill the dragon. We just keep going back to the well and getting the same things. When somebody like Carson Edwards gets hot like that, now, like, you know, we're not going to let the ball get out of his hands. And, you know, we're going to make sure he gets the, kind of the right of first refusal. And if they want to overdo some things, then we got to be able to make good decisions and move it. And so it's different. Like, you know, you're going to coach a guy like Carson Edwards once. You just are. Like, he's a very unique player. You know, Caleb Swanigan was a unique guy. Like, he's very talented. He's big. He's cerebral. You know, I don't know if I'll coach anybody like him. I think that's kind of, when it comes to greatness, it's rarely ever duplicated. Our all-time leading scorer is a guy named Rick Mound, who's the first high school player ever on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I'm yet to see another Rick Mound. Right. There's only one of them. So you try to take what you have right now. Like, for me, like next year, like people say, well, how are you going to handle things next year? And I really believe this. I'm waiting for them to tell me. You work on things. Yeah, I think we're so quick as coaches, and people say, well, he's the coach. He's the head coach. You know, what are we going to do, coach? You know what I mean? When in reality, it's a player's game. And when I mean by saying I'm waiting for them to tell me, I'm waiting for them to tell me through their work and their actions, not them walking in and saying, hey, coach, I think we should run this. Like, no, that doesn't work.
No,
I'm waiting to see. Yeah, I'm waiting to see. Who's improving? Who's getting better?
Yeah, and if you didn't approach it from that philosophy, you'd be discounting all the work they're doing from now till next season. And that's the
question.
All this work that you get to put in with them is that they're going to define a little bit more their role through this process.
No question. No doubt about it. So,
Coach, talking about a player like Carson Edwards, I mean, a few things stand out. Is one, is it hard to balance his talent and his ability to score one-on-one or to pull up and shoot with executing in the half court? Is that an easy to define balance because players know how talented he is? How does that process work within a team?
Yeah, you know, for Carson, as you go on, you always work on things. And so you always are trying to help guys, whatever. As you get to that point with a player and they don't make improvements in certain areas, that's who they are. You know, you have 4 years in college. That's who they are for that time period. I think you still keep working on some of those things. And really for him, it's his mindset and his vision. He sees down when he drives. If you're at the rim, if you're around the rim, if you're in the paint when he drives, he sees you and he can make that play. If you're out and he gets east and west and gets in the paint, he can see you to a degree. If he gets more north and south and you're out, he doesn't make that play. When he gets bottled up, sometimes he's great at getting by guys, and then it opens up for him. He's going to be able to see that better. If it doesn't open up for him, then he doesn't have that vision. And so as a coach, when you look at those things, a lot of people would say, hey, man, you got to see that. You got to see that. And I'm no different than anybody else. You know, anytime it happened, I would always say it to him. But you also have the understanding that he's not making that play. That's not his play. That's not who he is. So learn to keep coaching him, keep talking about it, but embrace that he's probably not going to make that play. You know, he's going to look to shoot in those situations and score that more than he is going to just, you know, be able to do it. So, you know, you get two people on the basketball, you get the ball out of your hands.
Is that a constant communication to your role players or to your other players to just get them to understand?
Yes.
And then as the season goes on, is that something they buy into more, or do you still see frustration as the season goes on sometimes?
A little bit of both. It depends on the person. You just try to be open and, you know, honest about here's where we are. Here's the situation. Here's who has the basketball. Because we talk about it a lot when we play 4-on-4, no dribble in practice. We used to do that more than we do now. But we would always say, hey, I've lost my dribble, but yet you're not going to come and help me. You know, I've lost my dribble, but the game we're playing is 4-on-4, no dribble. Nobody has their dribble. So we're constantly relieving the basketball, constantly moving the basketball because we can't dribble the basketball. So if I get stuck in the corner in a real game, I'm stuck in the corner, like, come relieve the basketball. So we're working on relieving the basketball and then getting it reversed and getting back into action. Also, someone who can't dribble. Sometimes you'll have a big guy who gets put in a different difficult spot. Come relieve the basketball, you know, come help me. And so this is no different than the education of here's a scenario, here's who has the basketball with it. But as a coach, now the one thing that we got to do is we got to bring the value out of Carson Edwards. So don't try to make him something that he's not. I always like him on the hunt. I always like him looking to score because I think he's a, I know he's a better decision maker when he thinks score first. He's not as good as decision maker when he thinks, okay, I got to pass this basketball. That's how he's wired. And people would say, well, that's not right. Or this is not right. Hey, that's who he is. So embrace the player that you have to help make your team better with it. But this isn't going to be the same for everybody because everybody's wired that way. An immature young player that has to play with him might not get that. They might not get that. They might never get it. I definitely don't believe anybody around them and their parents, you know, they're going to believe it, but they don't know. And this is about making your team better with the people that you have. So as a coach, you just have to be able to talk to your guys and understand, you know, who can do what, you know, who's good in each situation. But there's always that frustration that comes in. Frustration can be a positive sometimes too. And I think anytime somebody gets frustrated or somebody gets, you know, it's a great time to be able to, when that frustration leaves their body, to be able to talk to them about why they're frustrated, how we can improve it. It's not always their issue. Their frustration could be through other people. And then those people that maybe they're frustrated with, now discussing some of those things, you know, with them in terms of what we need to do better and correct. The thing you got to understand about how guys feel as players, when they get those feelings, whether it's, you know, the pressure of a game or it's fear or it's anxiety or whatever it might be. And so you have different players that have different feelings or do whatever. They always need to know that they can still do their job. And sometimes that gets lost. You're like, oh, the pressure of the game got you, or the, you know, the anxiety, or the, you know, that stage, or, you know, whatever the hell people, the words people use. Always let them know, like, you can still do your job. You know, we know what we're doing. We're prepared to do this. We can still do your job. It's okay to feel the way you feel, but don't let that stop you from playing ball screen defense. Don't let that stop you from sprinting. Don't let that stop you from picking up your teammate. You know, get engrossed with the game and doing your job. And really, the guys that have that mental toughness and that discipline, they're really just doing simple, fundamental things over and over and over again. That's all they're doing. You know, you'll see spectacular plays at the end of a game. A guy makes an unbelievable play. You know, you see Kevin Durant make a step back, pull up or whatever. Man, that's walking in the park for him. It's not walking in the park for me or you, but that's walking in the park for him. He just needs to get to his spot because that's what he does. That's his repetition. That's his deal. Is it difficult? Yeah, it's difficult. But for him, that's his baby right there. You know, he's mastered that. And a lot of times guys want things before they've gotten to that mastery level or they put their work in. They're like, well, you let this guy do this. It's one of the dumbest comments players have ever made in their, you know, their careers. You let this guy do this. You know, you're trying to do what's best for your team. I don't encourage people to shoot pull up 30 footers like Carson Edwards. It just, you know, it doesn't make sense to do that. He's been a guy, there's times I don't encourage him, but when he's got it going and he's in that rhythm, you know, we can't get enough rhythm shots where he lands on 2 feet. You just can't, right. You know, he's that dangerous of a scorer. So when guys want like the equal opportunity shot selection and shots and minutes and stuff like that, it's like, hey man, this comes down to the value of our team and what you can give it with all the pieces. And so there's a lot of dynamics that go through that. And I've heard a college coach talk about like dealing with parents and dealing with different people. It's like, they will come to a game and watch your games. They're not at your practices. But the other thing that you can't explain to them, you know, next year will be my 31st year as a player and a coach in college. I can't explain to them my 31 years of experience. I grew up on a college campus. I grew up on Ball State's campus. I used to go watch Ball State's games when I was a little kid. I got recruited, so I went to games. I watched games. I've been watching games since I was 6 years old. I'll be 49 this summer. So I've been watching basketball for 43 years, but I've been in college basketball for 31 years. How can I explain to somebody who's close to one of my players all the experiences that I've had and I make sense to them? It's not going to ever make sense to them because I'm wired the way I'm wired through my experiences, but yet they're talking to me about what they see through a game. And if they're upset, normally this person's not playing 25 or 30 minutes. He's playing 5, 10, 15 minutes. And you can't. It's a no-win situation. I mean, it's very difficult because the dynamics of doing what is best for a team isn't always the same. And they'll use their experiences. Well, they do this and they do that and they do this. Well, it doesn't work. It just doesn't. Like if I would have played this year like I played the previous year, I don't know if we'd have been over 500.
Right.
We just wouldn't have. And while we're 6-5, we still had three games that we felt that we could have won. And so we're not far off as we think. And we really didn't change our lineup very much outside of one position. And we ended up going back to that person who started before, and he played the same amount of minutes. And he played more minutes than everybody else, even when he came off the bench. And so the other four guys stayed the same. People said, well, you need to mix up your lineup. Why? These guys are give us the most value. They give us the most value every day in practice. This is easy to me. Like, this was easy. This isn't we don't need to change our personnel. This is really easy. But we do need to play differently, and we do need to make better decisions, and we do need to guard better. And I do need to be able to get those things through to our team better, but we're not that far away. And so when that happened and we really made a move, we played one guy a little bit more. He came off the bench. He started a little bit for us. But at the end of the day, he played 12 minutes on average, you know, for the season. So a lot of those things that come into play and you see like individual guys, if you have good guys and you just communicate, and even though sometimes they don't totally agree, if you're just honest and forthright with them, and, you know, and I think that's the message to send to coaches is build your relationship with your player. They're old enough. They're 18, 19, 20 years old. They're going to have some people close to them that aren't around. If they're honest with themselves, they're honest with, you know, things will work out. They just will. But I think the most important thing is being forthright with them, being honest with them. But when you start talking to people that aren't there every day, it's not going to make sense to them. That's the hardest thing, I think, for coaches to really kind of, you know, that frustrates coaches. We talked about frustration from players. I think that frustration, we always want to make that right. And we just can't make that right. You can be honest, you can be direct. And I've dealt with other guys that have been coaches before. They've been high school coaches and stuff, and they've been great about stuff like that. But they've also not understood part of it because they're not there every day. But I don't try to do that on my end when people start talking about, you know, hey, coach, what do you think I need to do with my team this year or whatever? I think you need to listen to your high school coach. Like, that's what you need to do. He's the coach. Like, he's the one in charge. And whenever I hear somebody complaining when I'm in recruiting, they start complaining about their coach, I always tell our assistants, I said, you know what? If we get this kid, I go, you know who's next on the complaint board? We are. Because they're complaining about him, but that's their habit. When you hear people complain all the time about their coach, if they get a new coach, then that guy's next. Because that's their habit. They have created that habit of when things go wrong, you know, instead of taking a step back and saying, hey, man, you got to listen to what he's saying. Hey, go in and talk to him. Love it when a guy comes in and talks to me. I love it because he's there every day. He knows. He knows what I'm going to say. And that's the one thing about recruiting is just tell him this is how it is. This is how we're going to do it. Like if no one in that locker room was promised anything, if no one was promised playing time or starting and they know everything's on the up and up, man, you've just helped your culture. You just helped your chemistry. And, you know, you might lose a couple guys in recruiting that way because they want to, you know, they want to hear what they want to hear. But the ones that you do get, that's who you get. You know, you get judged. You know, you get judged on the ones you get, not the ones you don't get.
No, that's great. It's great stuff and great message to everyone. And coach, maybe I just wanted to touch on one other thing. And that's that within your incredible success at Purdue, you also had kind of a down 2 years or so.
Right.
Now, what's important for coaches to understand is I think sometimes we just perceive all, you know, Matt Painter goes in, he builds a program, and then it's successful forever. But success is hard. And that's what I think people don't appreciate about your success there or another coach's success somewhere. It's really hard to be successful and to maintain it. Can you talk a little bit about that process of midstream, you know, having a little down period and some of the things that coaches should focus on to get back to success?
Yeah, I think you have to have some pillars of what your success look like. We all are going to copy the people we've been around or we've competed against, or we've admired from a distance. We had, when we were successful, to start with at Purdue, it started with Carl Landry and David Teague, two guys that Coach Katie had here. You have to have a start. And Coach Katie's last year, and then my first year, we got last and second to last. And both those guys that I mentioned in my first year tore their ACL and they were out. So we thought my first year we could be pretty good. But since they tore their ACL, it was a rebuilding year. And we got last in the league. And then we were able to go from last to fourth in our league. I think we tied for fourth and we won a game in the NCAA tournament. We beat Arizona in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And then the second round, we got beat by Florida, who ended up winning the national championship. That was a great start for us. I think a lot of times when you start, you know, there has to be hope. I know
of
everybody
course,
like
yeah, but it
guys,
raises expectations, right?
Correct. And that's fine because we had an opportunity to sell because those guys were leaving after that year. And it was a really good class. The 2007 class, high school wise, nationally, is one of the best, you know, probably the top five classes ever in recruiting. And so, but in the Midwest, it was really good. It was Derrick Rose. It was Eric Borden. It was OJ Mayo. So you had a lot of really good guards, good players in that class. Kevin Love was in that class. I think Kyle Singler might have been in that class. It was just a really, really good class. But in the Midwest for guards, you know, you had some real heavy hitters. And so we were able to sign a class that was able to come in here. And they were really good, but they were physically weak. But they made an impact. And a lot of people didn't think that that could happen right away just because the Big Ten and the reputation it has from a physical standpoint. And these guys were able to come in right away and make an impact. We signed two guards in the previous class that really helped us, in Keaton Grant and Chris Kramer. So they were able to be freshmen when Landry and Teague were there. And so we got a good start. And sometimes people just don't have that start. They just don't. So we were very fortunate, and the timing was there for us to be able to sign those guys 2 years before that class. That was the Greg Oden, Mike Conley class. Luke Herangode was in our state. But also in that 2007 class in our state, we got Juwan Johnson, Etuan Moore, Robbie Hummel, and a guy named Scott Martin, who transferred after his first year to Notre Dame. We got those four guys, but Jeff Teague went to Wake Forest. Matt Howard went to Butler. That's in the same class in the state of Indiana. And the impact, Matt Howard might have more impact on a school than anybody since I've been at Purdue. Like, you know, his impact on that program going to two Final Fours, you know, was huge. And our guys, those three guys' impact on us was huge. And Jeff Teague left after 2 years, went to Wake Forest. They're ranked number one in the country at one time. So when you kind of look just within your state, but you also look, you know, at Eric Gordon being the Mr. Basketball, you know, Derrick Rose being, you know, in Chicago, which is 2 hours away from us. So, you know, that impact and, you know, being able to get going with your program is so important. But we had two things that benefited us: Landry and Teague being there for us and being all conference guys. Sometimes when you take a job, you don't have those guys to get you going. Then that opportunity, you know, a lot of attention went towards Eric Gordon and Derrick Rose and OJ Mayo and all those guys. That's where the heavy hitters went to recruit those guys, and rightfully so. And then it just kind of like those next tier of guys would have been the main guys in a normal year. And we were fortunate enough to get in there and be able to get them and really build from there. We had a dip after those guys left. We went to six straight NCAA tournaments. And then we had 2 years where we didn't. Now we've been to five straight. And we've always been good with skill. So when we had a bunch of guys that can shoot, we've been pretty successful. When we haven't had guys that could shoot, and I think we got away from getting the guys that fit in our program, and we had to do a better job with that. We probably had, you know, Grady Eifert didn't have a Division I scholarship offer. Grady Eifert was the number one efficient player in the country last year in KenPom. Yeah. He was a walk-on, and he had no Division I scholarship offers.
You've talked about that, the value of recruiting mid-major talent at a Power Five, right? Because, can you talk about what that philosophy is?
Major, I think it's understanding a mid-major recruitment with the possibility of high major production. Right. And you'll find guys that can make threes, can make free throws, can take care of the basketball, can run offense, maybe are limited physically in some areas. They really help you win games. And so when you look at, you know, PJ Thompson, I think, had DePaul. I always say he didn't have high major offers, but I think DePaul had actually offered him at one time. You know, Ryan Klein did not have high major offers. What do you think if Ryan Klein was a fifth year right now? How many high major people would try to get him?
Yeah.
He obviously can't because he played 4 years. Yeah, a lot, everybody. I don't think there'd be a program in the country that wouldn't like entertain taking Ryan Klein, but yet anybody in the country could have had him 5 years ago. So when you look at PJ Thompson, you look at, you know, Grady Eifert, you look at Ryan Klein, Dakota Mathias had West Virginia. That was his only high major. Matt Harms had a lot of people, you know, looking at him. He had a couple high major offers. He would have ended up if he waited, having more, obviously at 7'3". But Matt was unbelievably skinny when he redshirted, really worked at it. But all those guys that I mentioned all go in the same bucket. They're all cerebral. They all have a skill level. You can run offense with all of them. They sacrifice to help Purdue win. And I think some of those things that I talk about, when guys get evaluated and guys get ranked, it gets lost. It just does. And I'm guilty of doing it. I was guilty of doing it in that one stretch. I think it's human behavior. You have to be able to, you wish you didn't have to do this, but you have to be able to relearn some things at times. It's no different than watching a movie and you've seen it 4 times, but you hadn't seen it in 3 years. And you're like, how in the hell does this movie end? I've seen it 4 times. I know I've seen it 4 times, but first time I saw it was 20 years ago. Last time I saw it was 4 years ago. I really don't know how it ends. Well, that's how the human mind works. And, you know, you do have to relearn some things. And that was a hard process. In coaching, sometimes you can't reshuffle the deck. And I was fortunate enough to be able to reshuffle the deck. And a lot of times when you try to reshuffle the deck, when things don't go your way or you've made, you know, some poor decisions as a coach, which I did, they reshuffle you and, you know, you get let go. And too many guys don't get just a little bit more time to be able to get it right. And I understand the decision makers, if they don't see that coming, a lot of the decision makers have never been in your shoes and they don't get it. Also, they're getting people telling them, we got to make a change. We got to make a move. And, you know, I've watched it, you know, I've watched it in our conference all the time. They change coaches
back.
Too much.
Sorry to connect this back, but it comes back to what you said already, which is that, say, a parent, they've never been in your practices. They really don't know. Isn't it the same for most administrators? Like, they really don't know. Like, it's really hard to evaluate a coach unless you're there day in and day out.
And I would say this, even if they are there, if you don't have the understanding of the game and team building and the concept of what you're trying to do, it's hard. It's hard. It's like me evaluating something like I'm locked in to the game of basketball and college basketball. But if like you sent me into an NBA world, you know how many things I wouldn't understand? I'd be like, well, hold on here. I watch the playoffs every year since I was 6. I understand what's going on. No, I don't. No, I don't know what's going on because I've never been in the front office of an NBA team. I've never played in the NBA. I've never coached in the NBA. You know how much experience and how many things those guys have learned throughout the years for on-job training. If you're evaluating somebody and they're on-job training, but yet you haven't been on job, and you just kind of watch from a distance, that's the decision-making that goes into a lot of times of guys getting hired, getting fired, getting evaluated. And I'm not saying that there's some guys out there that don't understand that from an administration's, you know, standpoint, because there are. But there's not a lot of them. I'll tell you that right now. If there was a lot of them, you would see a lot more people being patient with people, because that's the growth. You see the people in professional sports that stay with their manager and stay with their coach and they grow. Do they have their, you know, their ups and their downs? Sure. But they have more consistency than other people that are constantly making changes, but they just don't have the patience to do it. You know, you get your coach, you make the wrong hire in 2 years, 3 years, you're like, oh my goodness, I made the wrong hire here. I got that. But when you like the guy and he's a good coach and he's falling on hard times and, you know, they've had injuries or they've had whatever, they've had guys transferring or doing different stuff, just some normal stuff that's in our culture now, you stay with them and you grow with them and you are going to benefit from that consistency. But there's so many pressures to a lot of different things. I've been at Purdue 14 years and the only person in the room that was there when I walked in was Tom Izzo. But the people that have stayed with their coaches and shown that, I've had more success. Not to say that making a move is not the right call at times, because it is, but I just think that consistency, and sometimes the consistency isn't what the fans want. You know, they get tired of you when you've been somewhere. It's just a natural thing. They get tired of you. They want, sometimes they don't want as much success as they want to see something new. They get, you know, like, he's going to do this again. Look, this coach is going to do this again. Well, sure. You know, you're creatures of habit. A lot of people come at me for not zoning or whatever. And I say, okay, who's won the Big Ten that primarily zoned? And it gets silent, just like you just got silent there. I said, hey, I don't care. Go back since I was born from 1970. Go back and tell me someone who has zoned and that's their primary defense. Go tell me how many times Bob Knight won the league. Go tell me how many times Tom Izzo won the league. Gene Cady won the league. Thad Mata, Bo Ryan, Bruce Weber. I mean, just go back and look at all the people that have won our league. Man-to-man defense. Why that is in the Big Ten, I don't know. I didn't set those rules, but I'm trying to win the Big Ten. And I know if we can win the Big Ten, we won the Big Ten this year, we got a 3 seed. The year before we got second, the Big Ten, we got a 2 seed. Year before that, we won the Big Ten, we got a 4 seed. And so it just seems like if you can win the Big Ten, you're going to put yourself in a good position going to the NCAA tournament and give yourself a pretty good chance. And, you know, and so like sticking with some of those things, but no matter if we win, there's still going to be some people like, if you went to a zone right here, you are not going to please everybody. You just aren't. But you have to do and be, you know, you have to do what you think helps your school the best. But sometimes when guys get into situations and there's a little bit of failure, inconsistency, you start to listen to all that. And that's hard, man. That is hard for guys because now you start trying to please everybody. And then when you start to do that, you know, now your days are limited. It just is. It's too bad. In our profession, it's very competitive, but I feel for the coaches that get in that spot, but also the understanding of no matter what you do, they're going to be upset. Somebody's going to be upset. So you might as well do what you think is best because in the long run, that's going to give you the best chance.
Well, this is it's incredible real talk there, Coach. Thanks for sharing that. And thanks for taking time today to share all these ideas, and so many coaches will get great value out of that. And we wish you all the best moving through the summer and into next year. And again, thanks for being on the podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.